I begin today in chapter 19 of the book of Deuteronomy. We're going to be at verse 14 in a moment. Deuteronomy is Moses' final address to Israel before he dies. And so he is reviewing the law given through God, starting at Mount Sinai, but all through the 40 years that Moses has been serving as the leader, there's been a whole bunch of additional commandments and case law that he has been responsible to pass on to the Israeli people. And so as he's trying to prepare them to go into the land, he is reviewing and cramming all this stuff into their heads because he wants them to succeed. And to be quite honest, as we will see later, he is really concerned that they're going to fail because they're not going to take him as seriously as they should. That's always the worry of a parent or a teacher or a leader, is that those younger ones that you're trying to impress the importance of something upon won't take you seriously. So Deuteronomy 19:14. You shall not move your neighbor's landmark, which the men of old have set, in the inheritance that you will hold in the land that he who is your God is giving you to possess. Nowadays, when we survey our properties here in the United States, there have been little survey stakes that have been driven into the ground at key places that the surveyors can strike a line off of, and then they write down the description based on where that nearest stake is, and then all of those maps and specifics for a piece of property are kept in different official places, as well as given to the person that purchased the property. So those stakes in the ground, it is illegal to move those. Those are there to make it clear how private property gets divided up. Same thing happened without the stakes back in the time of Israel entering into the land. We've talked about how they're going to divide it up into larger tribal regions with the divine lot. And then they're going to subdivide each of those tribal regions into smaller subsections, and then even smaller sections of those sections until everybody's got a family farm or a piece of property as their inheritance. And there will be specific markers placed. Stones are the best marker, apparently. And they will be indicated on the written description of these properties. And so the warning here is, don't try to steal somebody else's property by moving one of the landmark stones. That will get you in big trouble because God is the one that's dividing up the land. Don't mess with God's directions, or directives, directions, and divisions. Verse number 15. The single witness shall not suffice against a person for a crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses shall a charge be established. This is a biblical principle that we see in the New Testament as well. You can't condemn anyone. You can't come to a conclusion of a case based on the declaration of a single person. Because basically it's he said, she said, that sort of thing. Or he said, or she said, she said. It's just their word against their word. And that won't cut it. We need two, at the very minimum, three would be better, independent testimonies regarding the incident, the situation. If you don't have it, then you can't find a judgment against that person. Verse 16. Now, here is the warning for perjury in such cases. Perjury meaning to provide false testimony. Now, we're not talking about mistaken testimony. We're talking about intentionally lying on the stand, lying about the situation. That's perjury. Verse 16, if a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before he who is, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. So this is one of those cases where apparently there's he said, she said situation. It's one person against the other. And one of them is quite insistent that something needs to be done. And so they won't let it go. Well, the ultimate appeal goes to God himself. And the judges at different levels try to deal with it. But eventually, God's the one that's going to have to make the clear decision using the Urim and the Thummim, it sounds like. But anyway, the judges shall inquire diligently. So they're going to do a study. They're going to do an investigation. And it's possible that they themselves are going to find out what the truth is. So if the witness is a false witness, so maybe they find other witnesses. And those witnesses make it clear that this guy is lying. And he has accused his brother falsely. Then you shall do to him, meaning the false witness, as he had meant to do to his brother. And so you shall purge the evil from your midst. So in our society, if you perjure yourself on the stand, one of two things, maybe a combination of them, is going to happen to you. You could be fined for making a false statement. You could be jailed for making a false statement under oath. In their society, given by God through Moses, whatever you were trying to get the court to do to the other person boomerangs on you. So if you were trying to get them to have to give up property, then once they figure out you're lying, you're going to end up giving property to the person. If it's money, same situation. There'll probably be some penalty money as well assigned by the judges. But here's where it gets a little scary. If you were trying to get him in trouble enough that he would be beaten, and it's found out that you were lying about it, then you're the one that gets the corporal punishment carried out against you. And if you were trying to get him convicted of a capital crime, meaning trying to get him executed, then you're the one that will be executed once it's discovered that you lied under oath about it. Now that, I think, would have a chilling effect upon our modern-day population if you were warned under penalty of law that whatever you say, if it's found out you're lying, whatever the penalty for the crime is, that's going to happen to you. Here it says in verse 20, the rest shall hear and fear and shall never again commit any such evil among you. That's the chilling effect of having these very strict laws. Verse 21, your eye shall not pity. And then we see a repeat of the Lex Talanis rule. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Because the judges in all these cases have the authority to carry out a penalty against someone that is equivalent to what they did or intended to do to someone else. And if that's the surgical removal of some body part, then that's what's going to happen to them. But if it's involving execution, you can't feel sorry for them. They lied under oath trying to get somebody else executed. That cannot be tolerated. And I am a firm believer in strong laws. I think that we should be very careful in all of our investigations. Everybody needs their due process. But I believe that very strong penalties need to be assessed against those that commit crimes. Now, I will say this. In the Old Testament, which I like to use as the model for my thinking on penalties, they didn't warehouse people in prisons for anything criminal. If what they did was a capital crime, then they were executed. They didn't need to be warehoused. And if what they did was not a capital crime, then there would be either a corporal punishment assessed against them or some sort of financial penalty would be assessed against them. And so I think that those are really the kind of the options that we should be still using today. I don't believe in long-term warehousing of people in prisons and jails. It's not good for our society. It's not good for those that have committed crimes that are not punishable by death because they're not paying back the people that they harmed by being warehoused somewhere. That's not helpful. They're not going to really be fixed in their thinking by that sort of thing. Also, takes a lot of money and manpower in order to keep those facilities open, and it's just not necessary. Back to the text. Chapter number 20, we have a shift in the topic to warfare, which the Israelis will go to battle during their history. So they need to know proper rules of engagement, code of conduct, because war does have rules. We have modern-day Geneva Convention laws. These are the sorts of things that the Israelis had. Deuteronomy chapter 20. When you go out to war against your enemies and you see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For he who is your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So first thing out of the box, Moses says, when you do find yourself at war, don't look at the numbers. Don't look at the equipment. Look to God. Remember that God is your king. Remember that Israel is the only legitimate theocracy in all of Earth's history. So God was the warrior king of Israel. And if he's the warrior king and there's war going on, then he's going to take care of it. Verse 2. When you draw near to the battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and say to them. So here comes the chaplain, shall we say, before the battle. Hear, O Israel, today you are drawing near for battle against your enemies. Let not your heart be faint. Do not fear or panic or be in dread of them, for he who is your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to give you victory. So the reminder, God is the warrior king leading you. You don't need to worry about this. He's got it. Verse number 5. Then the officers, and keep in mind that the Israeli people were not going to maintain a standing army at the beginning. They had a militia system. When they needed to go to battle, then all able-bodied men would muster out. And those that weren't physically fit enough would be sent home, the remainder became the army of Israel. And they were put under their own local officers, their own local commanders. It's actually not far afield from what we did here in the United States and colonial times before that in our early history. We didn't really believe in a standing army. In fact, some of the writings of the Founding Fathers believed a standing army was a threat to a free people because it could be used against them by a tyrannical government. And they were always concerned about a government becoming tyrannical. So here is Israel saying that after the priest chaplain has reminded them that they should not be afraid, then the officers, the people from the local tribal regions, are going to speak to their own people. And they're going to say, is there any man who has built a new house and has not dedicated it? So any of you just finished a house but you haven't moved into it yet? Raise your hand. And it says, let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. So new householders are excused from fighting. Now, they don't have to leave, but they're kind of encouraged to. Verse number 6. Is there any man who has planted a vineyard and has not enjoyed its fruit? Now, it takes several years. I think it was 4 before you could have the fruit for yourself from a newly planted vineyard. So somebody's planted it, but they haven't enjoyed it yet. Let him go back to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man enjoy his fruit. So another person that is excused from serving in the military. Is there any man who has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? So you've gotten engaged, but you haven't gotten married and had your honeymoon, anything like that. Well, they're excused. Let him go back to his house, lest he die in battle, and another man take her. And then, after going through several of these good reasons for people to head back home again rather than fight in this war, then they got to this, verse 8. And the officers shall speak further to the people and say, is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? So, is there anyone here that is not just simply nervous, but you are really scared out of your head right now? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own. Meaning, this is going to be a volunteer force, which, while I support the idea of a militia where everybody should be called up to serve, I also support the idea that there should be some volunteer aspects to it. If they are just too scared to fight, I don't want them in my unit. If they are also conscientious objectors, meaning they don't believe that they personally should fight in a war, I don't want them in my unit. Let them go be part of a medical unit or some sort of support unit where that they're not violating their own conscience. I like the idea of mandatory national service, such as other countries have, but I believe that only those that want to be in the military side of it should be in the military side of it. The rest of them should have an option that doesn't involve the potential of combat. All right, so back to the text, verse number 9. When the officers have finished speaking to the people, then commanders shall be appointed at the head of the people. So now they finish up with the structure of command. Verse 10. When you draw near to a city to fight against it, offer terms of peace to it. Now, this is not talking about the Canaanites. This is talking about later, after they're already in the Promised Land. These are other countries around them that they end up getting into a spat with that comes to a military head. One of the principles of Scripture, and I like this as an ongoing principle in our modern-day military and police, and even in our own personal lives, is that you only use the amount of force necessary to accomplish an end to the hostilities. And so the first thing that the Israelis were to do was to offer for a peaceful conclusion. Verse number 11, if it responds to you peaceably and it opens to you, then all the people who are found in it shall do forced labor for you and shall serve you. When a war takes place, there's money that gets burned up, gets used up. And so at the end of the conflict, there's always repayment from the losing side to the winning side. And in ancient times, if there was not enough silver, gold, and other items, then the people themselves became slaves in order to pay off that debt. And that is probably what's being described here. Now, that's the peaceful way of solving the dispute. It's assumed, I think, that this country had attacked Israel already. Verse number 12, but if it makes no peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. So you will surround the city and try to get it to give up. Now, what happens if it doesn't give up? Well, you're going to have to basically break into it by force. When he who is your God gives it to you into your hands, you shall put all its males to the sword. So all of their combat-aged men, all of their militia, because they rejected peace, because they would rather fight, they end up being put to the sword. They're executed. Verse 14, but the women and the little ones, the livestock and everything else in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as plunder for yourselves. So that's the repayment of the indebtedness that comes from war. And you shall enjoy the spoil of your enemies, which he who is your God has given you. Thus you shall do to all the cities that are very far from you, which are not cities of the nations here. That's the passage that I'd already hinted at. This is not warfare against the Canaanites living in the Promised Land. This is for later. Verse 16, but in the cities of these peoples that he who is your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes. Basically, God is going to chase out as many as are willing to panic and run away. Those that resist and remain, the Israelis are going to have to execute. That's the way that it was supposed to happen with the taking of the Promised Land. But you shall devote them to complete destruction, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as he who is your God has commanded you, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against he who is your God. We have to really get our heads wrapped around this idea that the Canaanites were exceptionally sinful. You remember that God told Abraham that his seed, his descendants, were not going to move into the Promised Land until well over 400 plus years later, because, and here's the wording, the sins of the Amorites is not yet full. It hadn't reached this boiling point that would bring God's heavy-handed judgment on them. Now, the people of Sodom and Gomorrah and Zeboim and Admah, they had already reached that point. And you remember how bad they were. God agreed with Abraham, yes, if there's at least 10 righteous people in all of those cities, I will spare it. I will spare all of them. And of course, there wasn't. That's pretty bad for 5 cities. And so that's how bad it was in those cities in Abraham's day. Now the Canaanites that Joshua and Israel are going to go in and face are at least at that same level, just absolutely over the top sinful. And so that's why they are going to be eradicated. Verse number 19. When you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it. So now we're back to, you know, the practicality of carrying out a siege, which basically you just circle the place and stop them from getting supplies in. But it says, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. As for the trees of the field, the question is, are the trees in the field human that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. So besiegement eventually climaxes with ramps being raised against the walls so that ladders can be put up, or sometimes rams can be brought against gates. That takes a lot of dirt and fill, and you need wood to kind of keep that dirt in place, keep it from moving around too much, make it more firm. And so that's trees. And so the rule here was, don't touch the fruit trees, the trees for food. Why would you attack those things? Did they do anything to you? In fact, they're supposed to be there for food. Now, the other trees, the trees that don't produce food, you may use them to make your siege works. So there is, strangely enough, a little bit of ecology in warfare being taught here, because wars don't go on forever. So you don't want to wipe out an entire region. You don't just destroy everything so that you can win, because eventually people are going to need to live there. See you next time we can get into the Word.